Though every once in a while, for Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You are listening to KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, April 24th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Dan Raphael, Chris Gao, David Rosenberg, and myself. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Eric Tagadoff, Nadia Ramlagan, Edwin J. Vieira, and Antonio Gonzalez. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members, lovely people like you. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm speaking with Street Roots digital producer Kanani Cortez about the latest edition of the paper, The Spring Anthology Volume 2. Welcome to the show, Kanani.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to speak with me today. So, The Spring Anthology Volume 2, what is this issue of the paper all about?
So, if you were around for, well, you were, but listeners, if you were around for Volume 1 of Spring Anthology or the Spring Anthology in years past, what it is Street Roots kind of best hits from the last year, stories that we think are impactful and meaningful and also worth a reread, even though the time has passed. And so this Spring Anthology Volume 2 is wrapping up some of the special issues we have this month, and this includes some great reporting that was done, some about arts and culture, some about homelessness policy and food and more in Portland.
How did you guys select which pieces you were going to put in the anthology?
Yeah, so I think one of the things our editorial team was thinking about as we put together this issue was, one, what are some stories that, you know, we're seeing a continuation of that impact or of these same issues? So obviously one of them being the Portland sleeping ordinance or camping ban that had been reported on in November. And I think that is always relevant, and especially now, as we are seeing Grants Pass v. Johnson go to the Supreme Court, and we'll be reporting on that for Street Roots. But yeah, also things that were like, if you missed it the first time around, it's still worth a read, and things that people are doing in the community. And so just kind of having that broad look of what's worth reading again. And of course, I think all of them are worth reading again. And I think another big thing we wanted to showcase is the incredible freelancers that we work with and stories that we receive written by freelancers. So we have some of that in here as well.
I was hoping we could walk through the different pieces that are being reprinted in this issue, starting with the one from Melanie Henshaw called Javelina, Portland's only Native American restaurant, is slinging fry bread to eager crowds. What can you tell me about this piece?
So, like you said, this is a wonderful piece by Melanie Henshaw, and she went to Javelina, which is a Native American restaurant pop-up that was happening in December, and I believe it's still going on, and they're doing pop-ups around town, and this is just kind of highlighting the chefs and their mission with this food and restaurant pop-up and what it means to be picking food from their culture, and also, you know, what it means to be one of the only Native American restaurant or food pop-ups in Portland. So this is just a great opportunity to learn about it and to check them out and the work that they're doing. And so we also had a follow-up of this one where Melanie was able to report on some of the fine dining that they had done, another iteration of a pop-up that was, yeah, more geared to fine dining and Native American food. And so I think this is a wonderful entryway into that. If you don't really know anything about Native American food or just interested in trying food or checking it out.
Next in the edition is a piece from Jeremiah Hayden from November, which you alluded to earlier. It's titled "Circuit Court Judge Halts Enforcement of Portland's Sleeping Ordinance." Obviously, there's newfound relevance about that. Can you take me through a little bit of what that original piece was and kind of how it relates to what's going on now?
Yeah, so this was about the Oregon Law Center had filed a class action lawsuit against the city of Portland about the sleeping ordinance, also known as the camping ban to some. And essentially, it was challenging that this ordinance was violating the Oregon Constitution. And we've kind of seen this again as a few weeks ago, Mayor Ted Wheeler proposed another version of this. I think also with the intention that it will not, you know, be challenged the way that this one was. And so we are kind of seeing, yeah, what is the continuation of this issue look like? And it is obviously still very relevant. This was first published in November. Like I mentioned, Jeremiah Hayden is currently in D.C. reporting on Grants Pass v. Johnson, which is being heard before the Supreme Court. And I think that is really tied up in this because that case can have a lot of repercussions for how we're going to see some of these issues play out across the country. And I think right now we're kind of seeing, you know, it varies by region, it varies by state, whatever's happening at that level. But I think a case like this going to the Supreme Court is expected to have some impact on how we're dealing with these issues at the state level.
Yeah, it's a very interesting time, and definitely multiple levels that this sort of thing that was covered in November is coming back right now.
Yeah, and I think too that another thing that we are thinking about as we put this together is that kind of, you know, this serves as an archive, and I think as people who, you know, are taking up issue with the decisions of their policymakers and elected officials, it's really valuable to be able to look back and be like, well, you know, you said this thing, or we tried to do this policy or XYZ in the past. And so I think this is another great opportunity to kind of revisit the timeline of events as, you know, elections are coming around and, you know, policymakers or elected officials are making new decisions. I think the public also has an opportunity to kind of, yeah, look at the record.
The next piece in this issue is "Sima Space Brings Music to the Deaf Community" by Ellen Clark. What can you tell me about this piece?
Yeah, this is a wonderful piece about the work of, I believe, Nate and Miles, who are working on a nonprofit using haptics technology to bring music to the deaf and hard of hearing community. And so they kind of get an overview of what this technology, or they give an overview of what this technology looks like. And it's really wonderful photos here in this spread as well by one of our freelance photographers. And I think one of the things that they talk about is the haptic belt, which is a belt worn by whoever's participating to distribute those vibrations of the music. And so I think this is just a really incredible look at this technology that is here and that these community members are hoping to bring to others. And I think for myself, I didn't really know much at all about haptic technology. And so I think if that's something you're curious about or, you know, kind of have no knowledge about, this is a really wonderful way to learn about it. And we also actually followed up with, I believe, Miles Sebastian, who's in this, and he was awarded a field fellowship to kind of continue this work. Ellen later covered that. And so I think this is a really wonderful piece to just take a look at what people are doing in the community.
The center spread of the issue is about Portland teachers going on strike, which was not that long ago. It was one of the biggest stories of the last 6 months, but it's a good reminder.
Yeah, you're so right. I think about this a lot. And I think that I'm sure so many families and parents and students and teachers and everyone in the community are obviously still feeling the impact of this and what it meant, you know, for students, for teachers. And so this is a photo spread kind of just talking about what the Portland Public Schools educators and teachers were on strike for. There's some great photos and quotes here about, you know, what it means to these staff and also students and families. And I think another reason, you know, this is worth revisiting. One, it was historic. And I think this is worth revisiting because Portland Public Schools is incredibly large school district. And so it's really had a lot of national coverage and local coverage. But I think that so many of the families and educators and community and PPS are still feeling the impact of this, you know, due to the loss of school days, but also then following the ice storm and the school closures. And I know it's been quite a pickle to figure out how to get the rest of those school days in for the students. And that looks like, you know, a lot of compromises, I think, for families and staff. And so, yeah, I think this is just worth taking a look at. And yeah, especially as you're thinking about the impact now.
This issue also includes the article, Living in a Glass House. Despite public perception, Metro data shows housed residents are responsible for the most waste dumped on public property. What's the significance of this article? Why was it chosen for the anthology?
Yeah, I think that, well, first the story, like you said, is an overview and kind of data that Jeremiah went into about public dumping. And I think, you know, there's a lot of perception that people who are experiencing homelessness are responsible for so much of the waste and trash that we see in public spaces. And I think that this was a really valuable story because data that was taken from Metro showed that housed residents are responsible for most of the waste dumped on public property. And I think that this is really significant and continues to be as one of the things that I think Street Roots really focuses on and values is challenging these misconceptions about what people are doing and experiencing when they're homeless. And so I think that this was really important. And I think I hope that it challenged people's, you know, preconceived notions and they're able to look at this information and, yeah, challenge some of that. I think as well that, you know, collectively, nobody likes trash or like public dumping. And I think that there's an opportunity to talk about solutions here and like what is the need for people, housed or not, to properly dispose of their waste. And I think there is a cost barrier for a lot of people as well.
What are the takeaways that you hope people get from this issue of the paper?
I hope that, yeah, people continue to see the kind of broad and vast depth of things that Street Roots covers, whether you're a first-time reader or you're a returning reader, and just being reminded that so much of the reporting and work that we're able to do is really supported by the community and people who choose to support Street Roots, and also that we have a large investment in making sure that the people in our community have good information and thorough reporting presented to them.
Where can folks find a copy for themselves?
You can find a copy of Street Roots from a vendor near you, and the weather's looking really great. So I definitely think higher chances of running into a vendor while you're out and about. You can also find our work at streetroots.org or Street Roots on all social media platforms.
Well, Kanani, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you so much.
That was Kanani Cortez, Street Roots digital producer, speaking with me about the latest edition of the paper, the Spring Anthology, Volume 2. More information is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Reed Johnson. There's been some mention of Project 2025 in the U.S. media, but some observers believe the project is not being taken seriously enough. The project is a 920-page blueprint plan for the next Republican president that was written by the Heritage Foundation and other right-wing organizations. Ann Nelson teaches at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs. She spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg about the nature and significance of Project 2025.
Is what the right is doing with Project 2025 kind of a continuation of what started with Reagan, you know, this idea of rolling back all the gains that were made in the 60s and even before, or is it something really totally new?
Well, as I stated in my Washington Spectator piece, it is the newest iteration of a project that's been going on for over 40 years, where these same organizations have had similar goals over this period, although they've expanded them. But at their core are the religious rights, what you might call culture war issues, which is rolling back reproductive rights for women, rolling back voting rights for minorities, rolling back civil and political rights for LGBTQ people. So those have remained constant, and they overlap with the interests of the major donors, many of them from the fossil fuel industry, who don't want any environmental regulations and would rather not pay any taxes. So you combine those with measures to really restrict funding for public schools, public health, public environmental initiatives that are all paid for with tax money. So once you limit those, you basically concentrate more power and more money in the hands of the top 1% and less in the bottom 50%.
And you would say these kind of policies are already being implemented on the state level?
Oh, yes. There are various states that have been laboratories. But really, as you say, it goes back to the Reagan era. And at that time, you had measures that the administration carried out to limit the influence of labor unions. And that was a major issue in that period. And the labor unions in the United States have never recovered. In the 1970s, you had the greatest income equality of our lifetimes. That has been reversed. And now we have the greatest income inequality we've had for over 80 years. So the tax regimes that have been imposed under Republican administration have made it possible for many billionaires to get away without paying any taxes at all, whereas a disproportionate tax burden falls, you know, on people who make a minimum income. So it's been progressive. What is new about Project 2025 is that, you know, if you look back over 40 years, you have a Republican administration that takes these measures, a Democratic administration that will whittle away at them and maybe take a step backward into the more egalitarian era. Then the Republicans come back. Project 2025 tries to build on the authoritarian qualities of the Trump administration in the first round, concentrate more power in the presidency, and remove power from the federal agencies, and make the courts and the FBI more responsible for the White House, and take various steps to consolidate power in the presidency and to limit the possibilities of displacing the administration in future elections.
I mean, there's already a problem with the regulatory agencies, right? I mean, there's this constant revolving door. The people in the industries they're supposed to be regulating sometimes serve on these agencies. And you're saying that this could get much worse. You're saying that
What Project 2025 called for is to abolish the Department of Education and various other federal agencies, and to abolish various departments in federal agencies that are responsible for the scientific accumulation of data about the environment and pollution and about food safety, right? They want to abolish these services to the public altogether. So yes, the revolving door and some corrupt appointments are certainly a problem, but this is just sweeping the protective apparatus off the table.
So Trump has his own agenda. Is that any different than Project 2025?
The way to understand it is that there are over 100 organizations that have signed on in support of Project 2025. And very roughly, half of them are funded by the Koch Network. Roughly, very roughly, half of them funded by Leonard Leo's Catholic Extremist Marble Trust. And then there's an overlap between those two. And so it is impossible. It is impossible to imagine any Republican candidate being elected without the support of these 100 organizations. They are the ones that are driving the donor base. They're driving the canvassing. They're driving the strategy, as they did with Trump in 2016, but to a lesser degree than they would do now. They have more money and more capability now than they did. So you saw Nikki Haley trying to launch a candidacy that made a few gestures that were independent of some of these positions and failing like other would-be candidates. These are the people who are controlling the party. And it's important to note that in Project 2025, they state whether it's President Trump returning to office, whether it's another conservative or GOP candidate, this is the game plan. This is essentially the party platform.
Are the Democrats already pushing back against this? Or as you say, are they just trying to whittle away a little bit and not really take it seriously enough?
There have been various statements about it, including coming out of the Biden campaign, where they're trying to highlight the dangers that lie in its pages. I don't think there's a full-fledged campaign that stresses it at this point. And even though it's been released for several months now, it's over 900 pages long. It's very dense. It has many, many actions that would be very damaging that could be achieved by executive order early in the administration. It has other measures that probably couldn't be achieved, that simply aren't realistic or don't even make sense. So, for example, one of the lines in the text says, every child has the right to be raised by its biological father and mother. And it may be a failure of my imagination, but I can't imagine them coming in and abolishing the practice of adoption and foster care and all the other subsidiary ways that parenting actually occurs, right? That doesn't seem realistic to me, although I can see that what they were trying to word it as is an anti-marriage equality LGBTQ parental phrase, but the way it's worded is impossible to implement. So you can't read it as something that could be executed in every aspect of the text. But you do have to look at it as a very serious declaration of intent with much that could be executed.
How much attention has the project gotten in the mainstream media?
There have been a lot of references, but it's been very difficult to cover, partly because of its length and also because of the dense bureaucratic language. You know, I did read the whole thing.
Must have been exhausted.
It gives you a headache. But in my piece for the Washington Spectator, I pulled out 10 aspects that I thought the public needed to review. And, there are other groups that are pulling out items and signaling them as causes for alarm. Because as I say, this is a serious declaration of intent. And there's certainly a strong possibility you could have a Republican administration elected in November. So people need to know what exactly they're voting for. And I think that there are items in this document that would shock people and others that the majority of Americans would not agree with. They want no emissions controls. They even want to abolish energy ratings on your air conditioner, right? Because it is so much at the service of the fossil fuels industry that they want to withdraw the United States from the Paris Climate Accord and all other environmental international agreements. They just want to basically abolish climate science and climate policy. And as we know from the Trump administration, you could advance that through a combination of legislation and judicial rulings and administrative action. You could set climate science and climate policy back years by the combination of powers that they would have. And the planet and our country cannot afford this. I don't need to tell people in California, much like other parts of the country that are experiencing environmental crises, that this is exactly the wrong time to reverse climate policy.
Do you think there's anything in the project and the program that would turn off Republican voters if they knew about it?
I would have to think more about exactly how they would think about it. For example, there are Republican voters who have adopted children too. How would they consider this statement?
There's even evangelicals who care about the environment.
There are those. And I think that there are a lot of very middle-of-the-road Americans who would be just as happy to know what the energy rating on their air conditioner is and spend a little bit less on their electric bill, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is just common sense. And it astonishes me that the fossil fuels company haven't quite caught up with the rest of the country and think that they have to squeeze every last penny out of environmental degradation rather than just going with the flow and investing in clean energy. But, you know, I think that there are Republican voters that have a Prius too. You know, there are all kinds of things in this that they should object to. But the problem is that so many of the Republican voters have their attention focused on single issues by the media that dominates their environment. And quite often, those issues are presented to them in a fallacious way. So if you're focused on, say, abortion, what they're being told is literally that Democrats support abortion up to the day of birth of a healthy baby, which is false. It is absolutely false. But if you believe that and you're told that that's the one issue you should be voting on, then the rest of the threats that affect their actual lives don't really penetrate. But among the nuances in these documents are just rolling back rights on such a vast level that is almost hard to comprehend. So, for example, the introduction of this document wants to ban terms from all federal language, legislation, regulations, bills. And those terms include the word gender, the term reproductive health. Now, I have to assume that Republican women would value their reproductive health. I would assume any woman would. And how on earth do you serve it if you banish the very vocabulary? So the problem is that you have to go into the document, as I did, and pull out these passages to see what they're actually talking about. And my piece, I feel, is a contribution, but it scratches the surface. There's 900 pages in there to delve into. And what we need is a small army of people with specialized knowledge in environmental issues, and agriculture, and reproductive health, in the care of children, in public health, to go in and dissect this document and educate the public about what's being threatened. Another passage that bothered me a great deal was that it said that officials from the CDC should not be allowed to advise vaccinations for school children. So we already have a measles outbreak in 17 states in this country. You have a death rate among children of 1 to 2 per 1,000 in cases of measles, which could be very serious. They think that children and their parents should not be advised to be vaccinated against deadly diseases. I would assume that Republican parents love their children too. So it's a quite a sweeping document and one that has very, very serious implications.
Anything else you want to add?
Well, I hope that people can find a starting point. My Washington Spectator piece, which is called The Latest Attack on America, is one, but there are other groups that have put out very good guides to it. And just find the primers and talk about it with people. And I think that every candidate of any party who's running for office at any level in 2024 should be asked, do you support Project 2025? Yes or no? If they waffle and they say, oh, I support some but not other aspects, say, all right, what do you not support? If they say, I haven't read it, then you say, why not? And are you saying that you reject the support of the 100 organizations that have signed on to it? Hold people's feet to the fire. Don't let them obfuscate.
Ann Nelson is an author, lecturer, and consultant on international media issues. She spoke with KBOO contributor David Rosenberg about Project 2025, a blueprint written for the next Republican president by the Heritage Foundation and other right-wing organizations. You've been listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Reed Johnson.
We'd like you to meet a friend of ours who goes by the name of Killer Joe. Picture a so-called hippie or hip cat standing on a corner in a neatly pressed, double-breasted, form-fitting pinstripe suit. A pair of pointed-toed shoes with bold white stitches around the soles. A black shirt, long white tie. A black pencil mustache, and of course, a very wide-brimmed black felt hat. Killer Joe always has a pocket full of loot, but only the kind that jingles. You see, he likes to play the horses. He is most certainly a ladies' man. As a matter of fact, he is always willing to accept cash contributions from them for any cause, namely his own. The most important thing about Killer Joe that you have to know is that he's very much against manual labor. Killer Joe.
Hey, everybody, it's Greg McVicker, creator of Undercurrents. Glad you're listening. This is KBOO 90.7, Portland.
We invite you to participate in our brand new public affairs program, Once Upon a Time. Share with us your memories and touchstone events of your life.